MG is back, and it's electric. The MG ZS EV. From just €28,995, the truly affordable, family-friendly electric range. Go to mg.ie and recharge your soul.
It's Wednesday, December the 16th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. Just before we start today, a very last reminder that it is that time of year when we gather the entire Irish Times politics team in all their glory for our annual Ask Me Anything podcast, where we do our best to answer whatever questions you put to us. If you want to put your question on that list, you will need to get it into us at the very latest by 10 a.m. tomorrow, Thursday, December the 17th. You can send those questions to politicspodcast@irishtimes.com, and you can of course send them as written text, but since this is an audio format, we would really like to hear your actual voices. So if you record them as a voice memo on your phone and email them to us, they probably have a better chance of getting picked. So do remember, that's politicspodcast@irishtimes.com, and please do send us those questions by tomorrow morning, December the 17th. Now, I'm joined today by Jennifer Bray and Harry McGee, but before I go to them, our Europe correspondent Naomi O'Leary has joined us at short notice. Hi, Naomi.
Hi, Hugh. How's it going?
Good. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen was speaking this morning about the Brexit trade talks with the UK. Here's what she had to say.
As things stand, I cannot tell you whether there will be a deal or not. But I can tell you that there is a path to an agreement now. The path may be very narrow, but it is there. On fisheries, the discussion is still very difficult. We do not question the UK sovereignty on its own waters, but we ask for predictability and stability for our fishermen and our fisherwomen. And in all honesty, it sometimes feels that we will not be able to resolve this question. But we must continue to try finding a solution. And it is the only responsible and right course of action. The next days are going to be decisive. And I know I have said this before. And I know deadlines have been missed time and again. We must all walk these last miles in the same shoes. Thank you so much and long live Europe.
Now, Naomi, you're a fluent speaker of Eurospeak. Can you parse that statement for us? And is there anything interesting or anything that's changed within that?
I think what President von der Leyen is trying to do there is make a desperate appeal to the European Parliament to stop them from rebelling, because essentially the Parliament is furious that they're not going to have enough time, if a deal is done, to scrutinise it and ask questions of people who are experts and so on and in their usual process before voting on it. And basically they've begun to talk about refusing altogether to ratify the deal by the end of the year, and instead voting, saying that the only thing they're prepared to vote on is some sort of an extension, which I understand is quite legally and politically tricky. But essentially, von der Leyen is having to appeal to member states as well and appeal to the European Parliament not to lose their unity and to just keep going together for this final stretch to try and get a deal.
Is there any possibility of, not necessarily an extension as the way it was being talked about earlier this year and was firmly ruled out by all sides, but that if an agreement in principle is reached before the 31st of December, that we can push the ratification process into January?
The last moment to ask for an official extension was July, and the EU would have been only too happy to grant it, but Britain insisted that it wouldn't do that. And so now the options that are there are difficult. I mean, you could, in theory, there could be an agreement by the British government and by the member states to provisionally apply any deal and then hold the ratification process afterwards. But I understand it's quite legally difficult, and it's politically difficult as well, because it would have to be unanimous. It's quite controversial among member states. It's very controversial in the European Parliament, and then what the European Commission is saying is that either we get things done in a proper way with a vote in the European Parliament, or we're looking at some sort of temporary period of no deal, where technically, legally, the member states and the UK would have to apply tariffs and we'd have all of that disruption just mitigated by some of the contingency plans.
My understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that there's been some talk on the British side, you know, anticipating chaos in the case of a no deal in early January, that they wouldn't be applying all the checks just in practical terms, in terms of keeping things moving through the ports in the UK in the first few weeks, or maybe even the first couple of months. I mean, would it be possible to do something like that reciprocally, or is that just a legal nightmare?
Yeah, the UK has said for a long time that it's going to have a phase-in period, so people don't need to, they have a 6-month sort of period to start putting in the full declarations that they have to technically, and I can imagine them waving in trucks just to keep things moving. Whether things would happen on the EU side is, it's a really difficult question. The risk now that von der Leyen is fearful of is that there start to be mini deals between the UK and member states to do things like that, just to keep things ticking. You see how bringing it up to the very last moment, the British side sees it as a strategic advantage for them because they have a quicker ratification process and it's simpler for them, where it's difficult to keep the 27 together in this final stretch with when things begin to look like they're running out of time.
And in terms of the talks themselves, she talked about a narrow path. She was very downbeat, as we heard, on the fisheries issue. She did seem to indicate that there has been movement on the level playing field and governance.
Yeah, so essentially there's what it's come down to now, there's some sort of agreement on the state aid area where the EU is happy that it's able to sort of autonomously retaliate if it's unhappy with what the British side are doing. And, you know, Britain has long said that, you know, when it comes to state aid, it's not really that one of the worst offenders in Europe. It's usually sort of some of the continental governments that go more in for state aid. But anyway, the two sides seem to be happy on what they've agreed on that. Then the second part of the level playing field or fair competition issue comes down to standards and how they'll differ over time. And that's moved from basically an initial position by the EU that they wanted Britain to sort of remain in line to an acceptance that Britain wouldn't get worse than the current situation. But then the fear is that if the EU, for example, wants to really go properly after its climate targets and so on, they could really increase their level of stringency in terms of regulations. And then there could be this opening divergence between the two sides. And the big question now is, how do you manage that divergence? So what's the test for whether differing rules are actually distorting the market between the UK and EU? So how do you actually measure that? That's the first question. How do you prove it? And then what is the authority that's going to decide it? And then after that, what are the sanctions? So these are the open questions at the moment, and they are quite difficult.
And that's the famous ratchet issue, which we've been hearing about quite a lot over the last few days. Just finally, Naomi, I mean, you lay out there a very tricky version of the very narrow path, which Ursula von der Leyen mentioned there. What is the timing here? We do get the impression that the House of Commons, for example, could pass an agreement should it be agreed, you know, early next week or maybe even, I'm not sure, after what they call Boxing Day. But does that option close very soon now with the European Parliament? Does somebody need to come out of the door waving a piece of paper saying, here's the deal by, I don't know, Sunday evening, Monday morning?
Yes, I think so. I think it basically the European Parliament expects now to be holding some kind of a vote on December 28th after Christmas, between Christmas and New Year. And it's very contentious now about what that vote will be held on. And in order for them to have any time to even read this thing, remember, it has to be translated and it's going to be maybe 1,000 pages long. Then they're going to have to see a copy of it imminently. So essentially what I'm hearing from sort of powerful MEPs, the, you know, people who are on the trade committee in the European Parliament and so on, is that, you know, it's the end of this week. We've got days now. They have to see a copy, or, you know, they're just not happy with this ratification process. And it's going to cause a big headache for the EU side.
We shall leave it there. But I suspect we're only leaving it for so long. I think we'll be coming back to this very soon. Naomi, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Now, as I said earlier, Jennifer and Harry are here. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Slightly less exciting on the domestic front. I was trawling through the political coverage this week so far, Jen, and I thought, things are slowing down. And then I was reading Pat Leahy's Inside Politics Digest this morning, and it generally had a kind of end of term kind of feeling that things were slowing down and people were looking towards the door and thinking of Christmas.
Yeah, see, Hugh, you've been spoiled this year. That's your problem. You know, you've had all of these controversies and all these things to fill up your podcasts. And now there's a normal week of politics and we don't know what to do. But no, you're right. It is definitely winding down at the moment. I mean, all of the politicians this time of year, they're generally chugging through things to get them off their list. Usually the last cabinet is a really full one as they get work through a massive list of outstanding items. And then for us as journalists as well, we try to get a lot of stuff ready for Christmas for people to read, kind of longer reads and bits and pieces. So we tend to also go a little bit quieter. It's not that we're not busy, it's just that we're working behind the scenes. But having said that, there are some interesting bits and pieces up this week. And I think one of them is this plan for rolling out the vaccines. And this was released yesterday by the government in a big press conference. And to a certain degree, it seems to have kind of gone under the radar, but the report itself does actually make for very interesting reading, especially when you consider that this is the thing that's giving us all, you know, a bit of hope, really, about next year. And the task for the government cannot be underestimated. They really have to get this right. And this is one of those parts of the pandemic where, again, we are so directly comparable to our other countries in the EU, to see how everybody does it. And all eyes will be on the government to make sure that they do it right. So just to give you some of the main points that I thought were interesting from the report, what I didn't realise was that there's actually 200 COVID-19 vaccine candidates at different stages of development worldwide. Now, we know that we're signed up to 6 through an advanced purchase agreement via the EU. And in terms of how this will actually work, in a basic sense, there'll be an initial rollout, a mass ramp up, and then a period of open access, so where everybody can basically go and get a vaccine. So we'll move from a period of actually quite limited doses to a period of larger availability, but we actually don't know the dates of those yet, and I don't think we'll know until that meeting of the European Medicines Agency and the EU meeting next week. That's actually been brought forward to before Christmas, maybe to give us all a little bit of Christmas cheer, I hope. But the rationale behind the distribution of this vaccine, the way the government put it, is that it will be ethical, equitable and clinically driven. But the real reason for the prioritisation is because, like I said, when the vaccine becomes available, there will be more demand than there is actual vaccine doses. So you have to have a prioritisation there, and obviously it's ethical. So in the fullness of time, we'll have 5 locations where vaccines will be administered. So it'll be nursing homes, hospitals, mass vaccination centres like City West in Dublin, as an example, GPs and then pharmacies at the later stage of the process. So the hospitals will be the initial vaccine locations, and actually they'll have units that will go out to, like, kind of mobile units that will go out to long-term residential care facilities like nursing homes. And I think just from reading the 2 reports that were released yesterday, actually getting these locations up and running, these mass vaccination locations and the other ones, appears to be absolutely no joke, because every location needs the proper resourcing, the proper equipment. They need to make sure they're handling and storing the vaccine at the locations in the appropriate way. They need a thing called a standard operating procedure. They need specialist training on the site. And then for these, you know, these very special vaccines that, you know, need to be at extremely very low temperatures, there are additional steps then for preparing the vaccine, bringing it from its central location, fridges, I suppose, to those sites, and then to those trained vaccinators. So, you know, that's a huge undertaking, and we're only at the very, very beginning of that journey, I suppose. And there's a couple of other, challenges lying ahead for the government. One of the things that I thought was kind of interesting was in the report, it said that while the vaccine, we know a bit about the vaccines, we don't know everything, and that there's still, they don't really know if when you get the vaccine, maybe the severity of your disease isn't as bad. And maybe your symptoms, maybe you don't have any symptoms, but they don't know, according to this report, whether you can actually still transmit the virus. So you could, Hugh Linehan could get the vaccine, feel absolutely grand, but could you still carry the infection? And is that still a massive problem? So given that, you'll still need to be wearing your face masks, social distancing, washing your hands for really like the next few months, to say the least. So that element of the pandemic isn't really going anywhere. And there are other gaps, if you'll permit me, that kind of stuck out to me a little bit, kind of substantial gaps, I would say. And, you know, one of them is the issue of the workforce. So The plan says that they'll need to train additional vaccinators in 2021, and that they're looking at maybe at licensing of retired health professionals, or maybe maintaining the registration of people who maybe were, I suppose, about to retire. But it's not just the vaccinators, because there'll also be more admin staff needed. And then they're looking at the public service. But then, of course, when you do that, then there's concerns about non-COVID healthcare. Are we taking healthcare workers from non-COVID? We know how much non-COVID healthcare has suffered this year. So there's that. Then there's the digital infrastructure. There's been a lot of talk about this over the last few days. The report says in black and white, Ireland does not have a vaccination ICT system with the functionality that we need to roll out the vaccine. And that at this moment in time, they're sourcing and purchasing and implementing a digital system to be implemented by the end of the year. And we're nearly at the end of the year. I think this could be a big problem. And then there's all the questions around governance as well.
That's a really good overview of all the issues, and Harry, and they are huge issues. I think we should bear in mind that this is ultimately a fantastic news story. It's one of the great scientific achievements in modern medical history, the speed at which these vaccines have been turned around and are being brought to market so quickly. But Jen, I think, very well laid out some of the challenges, political challenges in some cases, and then some of the known unknowns, and I think particularly that one about transmissibility, and therefore which has a big impact on whether we can achieve the herd immunity, which is the kind of the ideal objective to get to at some point next year. But then looking at the report itself, it strikes me there's a couple of things about it. One is that it's quite careful not to set targets, and it's quite vague about numbers, and I think we can understand, you know, why that is. But the initial target groups, I suppose you could say, the people in the care homes who have been hugely disproportionately represented among fatalities, and then I suppose people in frontline health workers, they're quite gettable at without a decent ICT system, because they're already within, I suppose, the health infrastructure. But I get the collywobbles when I hear the words Irish health system, Irish government, and ICT system in the same paragraph, because the history of those kind of projects has been disastrous in this country to date. You know, vast amounts of money wasted and projects undelivered after years of attempts to deliver them.
Okay, I think you have now asked the longest question that you have asked this year, Hugh. Thank you very much for that.
Wait for my next one.
And you made a very, very salient and interesting point. And looking at ICT, those of us who have been around the block a bit will remember the PPARS scandal that happened 15 years ago, where the HSE, which was newly formed, tried to update its system and bring all the different health boards together under one roof, and that just became an unmanageable mess. With potential bills running into hundreds of millions of euro. And it was a very salutary example of how it shouldn't be done. But we do live in a modern age where communications is vital, and speed of connectivity and of information is vital. And for any vaccine programme that's so wide and so ambitious to work, it's going to need to have a very good ICT system backing it up. So it has to be done. But yes, what's happened in the past doesn't bode confidence. But we talked about this being a good news story. And I think that when you look at it holistically, when you look at the response holistically, I think the authorities here have responded well. There have been speed bumps along the way, and there have been times when NPHET and others have started pressing the alarm button a little bit too loudly, in my estimation. And I think there's been a disproportionate response. But when you look at it in its entirety compared to other countries, I think we've responded well. And I think the much derided HSE, the much derided Department of Health, the much derided various ministers of health have all surpassed themselves and done very well in relation to handling this crisis. And I think that the best slide rule is to compare how we have done with our comparators across Europe. And we have done extraordinarily well. Look at the situation in Britain. Look at the situation in Belgium, in Spain, France, Italy. Look at the Eastern European countries like Slovenia, Lithuania, the Czech Republic, Poland, where the numbers just escalated So, I mean, we have been up there with Finland, with Iceland, and with Norway in terms of the way that we have handled it. Even Germany, which put a lot of money into its handling and its of the crisis, has been hit with a fresh crisis in the past week. But the difficulty with this virus, as we all have learned, is as soon as we start patting ourselves in the back, something terrible happens. And if you look at this new strain that has emerged in Britain, and if you looked at Germany, for example, how quickly a new wave of the virus has spread in 1 week alone, you have to realise that you always need to be vigilant. It's a very infectious disease. In relation to the vaccine, I think the vaccine programme is a sensible one, because if you look at the fatalities, they're very heavily raked towards the eldest in our society. I think 94% of those who have died from COVID vaccine, the last time I looked at the figures, were those aged 75 years and over. And very few under 65 have died. Certainly very, very few who have had no underlying conditions. But that said, it's so infectious, lots of people get it. And the danger is when they get it, they pass it on to those who are most vulnerable and those who are most elderly. And from what I've read of the programme and the plan, I think it's a sensible one. I think they're also sensible, as you pointed out there, Hugh, not to set themselves targets that can't be reached. The moment you set an ambitious target, and if you fail to meet that target, the focus is on the failure to meet that particular target rather than on the good work that's been done. So I think that's been a sensible approach as well. Just going back to Jen's opening point, saying that it's been a week of normal politics. I don't think any week this year has been normal in terms of politics. And I just think generally when we look at the how it's played out for political parties this year, it's been the year of apologies. It's just been extraordinary. We had Brian Stanley yesterday, and he's the last in a long litany of people who have apologised this year. And you and I, Hugh, are old enough to remember a band that came from a place called Stourbridge called Pop Will Eat Itself. And sometimes I think that all political parties in the fullness of time will end up eating themselves. The Greens are at it this week over in a big row over the Canadian-Europe trade deal. And again, they're reviving all the divisions and all the rancour and all the bitterness that we saw during programme for government negotiations in early summer. And the dividing lines are almost the same. And that bitterness within the party, and bitterness is a strong word, but it is a bitterness. There is a kind of a split in there that has not been resolved, and I think may not be resolved. I think that Zeta might end up in one or two TDs from the Green Party going overboard in the fullness of time.
And let's come back to both those points, because they seem to me to not only be symptomatic of things that happened this year, but probably are going to drive some of the things that we're going to see happening next year. But before we leave the vaccine entirely, I do want to ask you, Jen, about the politics of this, and particularly from the point of view of Stephen Donnelly. It strikes me the politics are going to get complex and unpredictable in ways that we're not yet quite sure about. But if, for example, if the rollout goes well, and if those high-risk groups who have contributed so much to those people who have fallen seriously ill or even have died, if those numbers, let's say, start going down quite significantly in the spring, which they should do if this thing works the way it's supposed to, that's going to have a countervailing balance on the other side, on the economic side, with businesses looking for restrictions to be lifted as quickly as possible so that people can get back to normal, even if it is still out there in the community. And I wonder about Stephen Donnelly. Here he is, comes from this sort of management consultancy background. So supposedly he's all about deliverables and targets and all those kinds of things. This is probably the most important 6 months of his career coming up now.
Yeah, and a lot of people, you know, over the last few months have said it was almost not an easy decision, but an easier decision to go into lockdown, and a much more difficult decision and a much more difficult task to come out of it and manage all the various competing demands. From what I can see of Stephen Donnelly so far, he has been, like, by and large led by public health, by and large led by what the chief medical officer says, notwithstanding his own kind of background. And like you say, sort of targets and deliverables and McKinsey and management and all that kind of stuff. But I think you're right. I do think that when we get to next year, and if it does work out as it should, as we all hope it will, then yeah, of course. I mean, look, even in the last couple of weeks, even when we had much higher figures, we still had businesses calling, you know, to come out of lockdown or to ease restrictions. So if we had that now, of course, we're going to have it when things are looking a bit rosier in the garden. I think that's kind of almost next year's problem. But in terms of Donnelly and politically, I actually think the biggest challenge for him over the next coming months will be communications. And, you know, we've seen a lot of things political, a lot of things pandemic. The communications has been key. And when it's gone wrong or when there's been confusion, it has not been good. And it is very important. And particularly now in terms of a vaccine, multiple times in this report that we talked about, they mentioned the importance and the significance of getting this message across to the public. And I think one of the particular lines that stuck out to me was it called for precise coordination across government, several state agencies, the HSE, advisory bodies, regulatory bodies, delivery partners, the health sector, the private sector. Like, this isn't just Stephen Donnelly getting the message across to you and me. This is a really complex undertaking across a whole range of different bodies. And the message has to be the same, and it has to be clear, and it has to be well understood. And that's not just in terms of the safety of the vaccine or the efficacy of the vaccine, which we know will become a bigger and bigger question as it rolls out. It's how those different bodies talk to each other, particularly if something goes wrong, you know, and something probably will go wrong. You know, this is a huge program, probably the biggest program of inoculation states ever seen, you know, so it would be kind of naive to think this is going to be completely smooth sailing. So that will really, really matter, I think. And I think that the challenge for the Department of Health, that's, to me, from what I can read and from what I can see, is actually the biggest one. And at the very end, when they talked about their communications plan, I thought there was a really interesting line in it where they talked about research that they'd done at the Department of Health. And they said that a lot of people who doubt the vaccine are actually just in a dilemma. They want it, they want to get the vaccine, but they're cautious because they're worried this thing's been rushed out very fast. How can we be sure the corners haven't been cut? You know, they're worried about the speed of the development and they want to be reassured, basically. And they want to be told, yes, we haven't cut any corners. This is safe and this is effective. At the same time, the department will have to obviously own the fact that this is science. Nothing is ever 100%. There are no guarantees. And to have those two messages and make sure that people are reassured enough to get the vaccine. And we've seen previously with other vaccines, misinformation campaigns. I think we'll see this again. Sure, we've already seen it, kind of LED lines, lights going up on the side of roads. So yeah, I think that they probably will pick out ambassadors. I think they'll pick out trusted health experts is what the phrase they're using. I heard Micheál Martin last night saying on, I think it was Virgin Media News, kind of hinting that they might use influencers and stuff again, or every influencer they can use. So yeah, I think for Donnelly and for the Department of Health, obviously the logistics and everything, but that's kind of for the HSE, but the communications, they absolutely have to get this right.
Yeah, my heart sinks, Harry, at the notion of being bombarded with messages from Brezzy telling me to get my vaccine, you know, but I suppose that's part of, you know, the world we live in now.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I do rely on influencers when I'm doing my manicures and stuff, but I mean, for my health notices, I just don't know. I actually think Stephen Donnelly has done, he got a hammering when he became Minister for Health, and it was a little bit disorganised at the start. And there were a few articles in newspapers that purported to be assessments of him, and they absolutely hammered him. But I kind of admired him responding to them in saying, you know, I will respond to criticism when they come from named critics, because most of his critics were anonymous and were quoted as sources. But I do think that in recent weeks that Stephen Donnelly does seem to be performing more strongly. He seems to be more assured, and he seems to be, you know, he seems to be giving the impression that he's in charge. Now, I don't know whether that will work out for him in the long term, but certainly he gives me more confidence now as Minister for Health than certainly he did 2 months ago. But I think that Jennifer is completely right. I think communications is key, both for him and also for the government and for the Department of Health. And one of the things I've been cribbing about in the past couple of weeks is the messages that consoled us all back in March and April about all of us being in together and the Mehl thing. That's become exceedingly stale. So they're going to have to come up with freshly minted cliches to bring us through the rest of this pandemic. They're going to come up with new language and new ways of engaging, because otherwise people are already weary. I was on a road trip to Cavan and Donegal to see how lockdown was going there and why the numbers were so high. And one of the things that struck me was the weariness of people. People are getting very tired. Small towns across Ireland have been dead and were especially dead during the weeks of lockdown. And people were really concerned about their jobs, about their work, about business and about the future. And the thought of a third lockdown for many was intolerable. And one of the things that needs to change is that the message needs to change. It needs to become more bespoke, more tailored. The information has to be far more precise rather than these general platitudes. I mean, they were great at the start, but they have become platitudinous now. And the government really needs to think, because people are in danger of being patronised into oblivion by all of this. But going back, I think Stephen Donnelly has begun to improve. I think his communications has improved. But I agree completely with Jen in relation to the communications piece. That's going to be vital if people are going to be carried along into 2021. And we know that most people won't be in a position to get the vaccine until later on in the year. Going back to the initial point that you were making, I think it's extraordinary that within a year of a vaccine or of a virus being identified, we have a vaccine that's been rolled out globally. It's just extraordinary. When you look at AIDS, for example, which has been around for over 30 years and they still haven't come up with a vaccine for AIDS. If you look at another major disease that affects modern society, dementia and Alzheimer's, they've been really trying to come up with some kind of solution for those for many years. And they have come up with nothing that has been effective. So to do it in a year, I know the coronavirus was recognised and they knew kind of how to do it, but to do it in a year was just extraordinary in my estimation.
Absolutely. Jen, can I ask you about Harry's point earlier about this being the year of apologies? Different sorts of apologies, sometimes no apology, followed by grudging apologies, followed by less grudging apologies, followed by complete grovelling. And sometimes those apologies worked in terms of keeping the apologiser in their jobs, and on many occasions it didn't. Are apologies a kind of defining theme? And I'm a bit sick of them at this point. I mean, Brian Stanley, this thing has really gone on a bit too long.
I totally agree. I couldn't agree more. I mean, I know this is probably a bad thing to say as a journalist, but every day that controversy rolls on, I just kind of put my head in my hands and think, oh, I really want to write about something else. You know, I don't want to go around writing about Brian Stanley every day, like, believe you me. But yeah, I do agree. It is kind of the year of the apology. I think if we've learned anything about political apologies this year, if you're going to make a political apology, make it fulsome, be 100% in that apology, own that apology, put it right out there at the beginning, and don't leave any room for, you know, manoeuvre or for, you know, people to say, well, that was kind of a half apology. That's when it rumbles on. Look at what happened with Phil Hogan. You know, his first apology was kind of not fully there. And then as the kind of different revelations came out and the narrative kind of changed a little bit, we got kind of more fulsome apologies. And then, of course, we know what happened in the end. And I think it's interesting with Brian Stanley that there were two tweets. There was the one about the ambushes, and then there was a second tweet about Leo Varadkar. And both tweets upset different cohorts of people. So the younger members of Sinn Féin were more upset, to my eyes, at the tweet, you know, what they thought had some kind of undertone of homophobia in it, something which Brian Stanley absolutely strenuously denies that there is. And then there was kind of a different, it seemed to me more politicians were angry about the IRA tweet. And, you know, when this first developed and when we heard Mary Lou MacDonald out on the radio, she apologised in terms, well, she didn't apologise. She said that the problem with the first tweet was the tone. And obviously this was a problem for Sinn Féin. You know, are they going to apologise for the content of what's being said? Are they going to apologise for that? Are they going to apologise for what happened? And a campaign of violence? No, probably not. Or are they going to apologise for the tone? So I was watching particularly yesterday to see how would Brian Stanley address this? How would he go at it? And the way he did was he said, and I quote, "I accept that my tweet regarding the ambushes at Kilmichael and Narrowwater was insensitive and that it caused hurt and anger. Words can do that. And my words did. And for that, I am truly sorry." And I think that was probably a good way of, for him, of approaching it, because it comes across as a fulsome apology without really opening a different can of worms for him in relation to Sinn Féin and its past. And then like, for me, his apology yesterday was kind of short enough. He sort of just said, I'm sorry for this, I'm sorry for that, I will try harder. And he said he tried to ring, I think, Leo Varadkar to apologise in person. And I actually asked Leo Varadkar's spokesman last night, would he be willing to take that call or was that going to happen today? And he said, yes, if it can be arranged. So I don't foresee too much. I don't know if that's actually going to happen or not. But then the other thing I heard was that when someone makes a personal statement or an apology to the Dáil like this, in the standing orders, there is no room for any other statements from other parties afterwards or any questions or anything like that. You make your personal statement and you move, the business moves on. But I think there was, to say a campaign probably would be the wrong word, but a concerted effort in Fine Gael to change that. And they, I think they asked the Ceann Comhairle, could they come in and make statements and, you know, have their say? And they were told, no, there's no avenue to do that. And I think it just shows that even at this late stage of the year, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin are still at each other's necks and they're not resting at anything, not even with Christmas on the doorstep. And this is going to be, I think, a defining characteristic of the next year. And we're all already fed up of it. So can you imagine how we'll feel this time next year? So I don't know whether they're going to need to change tack or whether the opinion polls will change. But it's definitely, I can see us here at this other side of Christmas talking about Sinn Féin, Fine Gael and apologies.
And not necessarily about the major housing policy or health policy, but about sniping about things that people said in social media or what they did. Anyway, well, we'll leave that because unfortunately, I think you're right. We will probably have to return to some of that. But Harry, just briefly before we go, you did mention this internal disagreement among the Greens about this trade agreement with Canada. And it is a sort of harbinger for further problems ahead internally for the Greens in 2021, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, the Greens have been divided since the summer and they've lost a fair amount of younger members who would have been seen to be kind of just society people, people who would have been on the left of the party. There was a big debate about coalition. The party decided relatively overwhelmingly, actually, over 70% of the party favoured going into coalition. So that was settled. But then we could see the divisions within the party surface again during the leadership competition when Éamon Ryan survived by the skin of his teeth in the contest against Catherine Martin. So we've had, you're talking about the Sinn Féin, Fine Gael kind of dichotomy or this kind of narrative. Well, you have the kind of the revival of the Fundos versus the Relos, the Fundies versus the Relos in the Green Party, where there are two wings of the party, each kind of competing for the soul of what the Green Party should be about. And the realists are in the ascendancy. So this CETA is a very good illustration or example, a microcosm, as you will, of the of this kind of debate that is happening within the party. And it's the Canadian-European trade deal and environmental groups, which are a kind of touchstone for the Green Party, have campaigned very vigorously against it. Alice Mary Higgins, the independent senator, led, along with Lynn Ruan and one or two others, led a very lonely crusade against CETA in the Shannon when it was going through several years ago. But it did go through, but it's now coming up for ratification, even though most of it has been in operation for several years. But there are several parts of it that are very contentious as far as the Green Party is concerned. And one of them is this, these special tribunals to resolve trade disagreements. And they do give a huge amount of power to private corporations to sue a party to a trade agreement, which is a state, or in our case, the European Union, if a decision taken by that state or by that union has a deleterious or a detrimental effect on the trade performance of that company. And one of the big examples that's given is a case that was taken by the tobacco manufacturer, Philip Norris, against the Australian government several years ago in relation to a law it had introduced in the interests of public health. And as those who campaigned against CETA are saying, you know, for example, the Public Health Alcohol Bill of 2018, which kind of put limits on alcohol sales and marketing and advertising and pricing and what have you, The CETA could have had a chilling effect on that particular piece of legislation, because if a company were to show that this particular law diminished sales or had an impact, a negative impact on its sales, it could take a case to this tribunal, which kind of sits outside the current legal system. So that's the kind of the objection. Eamon Ryan was one of those who originally objected. His argument is that things have moved on since. And, for example, the primacy of the Paris Accord has been established. The European Court of Justice has also held, he argues, that public health law in Europe takes precedence over anything that's contained in a deal like CETA. But it hasn't really been hammered down yet. So there is a kind of a fault line there, and that fault line is evident within the Greens. So what's happened was that it was going to be ratified. Last Friday, Nasa Horrigan indicated to her party that she'd vote against if it wasn't deferred, and it has been deferred now until January. Now she and presumably others within the Green Party want to be deferred even further to allow ample time for debate. But speaking to people about it yesterday, I can see that attitudes are quite hard in relation to this on both sides. And I think that we're kind of heading for a showdown at some stage between those factions of the Green Party. And if that happens, it will have, at the very best, a slight destabilising effect on the coalition that's in power at present. Hope that wasn't too long and too convoluted an explanation of CETA. But given what CETA is like, I think it's as concise as I could possibly be.
No, I mean, we started today's podcast with disputes about international trade and the thorny details that are involved, and we ended it on a similar tack, which I think brings at least a certain thematic continuity, if nothing else, today's podcast. We are going to leave it there, though, guys. So thanks very much to Jen and to Harry. Thanks to Suzanne Brennan, our producer. Thanks to JJ Vernon, our engineer. And remember that if you want to get in touch with us, we are always delighted to hear from you. Just email us at politicspodcast@irishtimes.com and get those questions in for our Ask Me Anything. But until the next time, thanks very much indeed for listening.